This podcast is sponsored by the Center for International Business, Loyola University New Orleans College of Business.
Welcome to Gumbo of Opportunities, the podcast where we dive deep into the landscape of international business with a closer look at the state of Louisiana and New Orleans. We will hear stories, insights, and strategies of influential global players of the Bayou region in a pursuit to make the Bayou one of the most attractive areas for businesses. This is Gumbo of Opportunities.
Hi everyone, I'm Alessandro.
Good morning, Alessandro. I'm Gustavo.
Today we have a great pleasure of having with us Professor Edward Freeman, often called as the father of stakeholder theory. So he's a professor at the University of Virginia, Darden School of Business. His work has reshaped how leaders think about value creation, about ethics, and about strategy. We remember him from his seminal 1984 book, actually, Strategic Management, A Stakeholder Approach. And this book put stakeholders at the center of business decision-making, influencing scholars and executives all around the world. Yes. More than 170,000 citations in Google Scholar, but beyond that, he's also co-authored other books. I just want to mention another one, like The Power of End, Responsible Business Without Trade-off. And he also hosts the Stakeholder podcast, in which he advocates for a more responsible and a more collaborative form of capitalism. So, Professor Freeman, welcome to Gumbo of Opportunities.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
And it's Gustavo, it's a very interesting topic we are talking about today.
Absolutely. No. Ed, if I might call you Ed.
Sure.
It's a pleasure to host you here.
Thanks.
I want to tell a very, very simple story. I first met Ed in Chicago at the Business Society meeting, and it was a lovely presentation that was taking place, and there was this gentleman making comments somewhere halfway in the room, and everybody was looking at him, and for two things, because of his knowledge, but more importantly, because of his kindness and humanity and very, very affable way of providing feedback to young scholars. And I thought that was a very unique characteristic of you, knowing exactly where you are in the field, what you have done, and at the same time you were coaching and bringing up the next generation of, professors, faculty, and they felt like this was this father figure helping them. And that was very inspiring because you had the ability to communicate incredibly complicated concepts in a simpler way, but more importantly, in a very welcoming way. So thank you very much for being that figure, for bringing forth, the argument in the way you live of being a good stakeholder, knowing who are all the players and keeping them all within the same group in a very welcoming. So we welcome here you in New Orleans on behalf of the Center of International Business and the Ethics and Economic Justice Center. It is our pleasure to host you here, and we look forward to a wonderful conversation, and thank you very much.
Thanks. I really enjoy trying to give back. When I first started this, a PhD in philosophy, I didn't know anything about business. A whole bunch of people took me under their wing and really helped. And so if I can give back a little bit, plus it's fun. I really enjoy meeting with doctoral students and early career scholars and trying to help them, et cetera, find their voice. So that I think is the hardest thing in today's academic world, is to find your own voice. And that's the only way you make real contributions, is when you do that. So it's really, I look at it as a real honor to be able to help people with that.
Excellent. Thank you. Welcome to New Orleans.
Thanks.
I guess we can start just by learning the term stakeholder and stakeholder mm-hmm. theory. And it was funny because just before recording this episode, of course, I was corrected by Ed in a way that I was anticipating a question and immediately corrected me. And so I would like to have this anecdote to brought here into our episode. And I was going to ask, how did you come up with the term? And he said, no, actually, I didn't come up with the term. If I may, you refined it, right? you operationalized it.
Well, I also found out who did come up with the term.
Okay.
I used to say I was the only person to have written about this who did not claim to have invented it.
Yes.
And, you know, I learned in grad school in philosophy that you know, everybody was a footnote to Plato. And so people said, well, we don't know where this came from. And so I figured it out where it came from. It came from the Stanford Research Institute in the 60s and a man named Eric Rinman, who really was the father of industrial democracy in Sweden. All I did was try to figure out what it would look like if businesses took the idea seriously and ran their businesses in a way that said, hey, what we do is we try to create value for customers, suppliers, employees, communities, and the people with the money.
Yeah. I mean—
But I've never understood why people found that a big deal. I always thought that was about as obvious a thing as you could possibly say.
Mm-hmm. No, but I mean, this concept, the concept of stakeholder, as much as the theory of stakeholder, is of great value for all business students and for management students. Let's say that I'm asking you, how would you describe in very, very brief words this mm-hmm. concept to a first-year student, mm-hmm. student? And in particular, I guess, pointing out what is the real value of knowing what a stakeholder is and what is a theory of stakeholder?
Well, the way I often do it in class is I'll say, okay, Guillermo, you're going to have a great business here. And I'll ask the other students, what do you need to have a great successful business? And typically, especially if they've had a course already, they'll say, well, you need a business plan and money. And I'll say, okay, but what else do you need? Eventually, they'll say, well, you need a customer. Right, you need a customer. You need a customer more than you need a business plan, and you need a customer actually more than you need money.
Yeah,
because they have that. And then I say, so you're going to do all this yourself? Well, you might need a supplier. And you're going to get to a point where you're going to have to hire people. You're going to need employees. And you certainly want to do this business in a way so that communities don't run you out, that you do terrible things, you pollute the water, you put chemicals in the earth, or you do something that they don't like. And you're going to need investors. You're going to need money as well. Stakeholder idea is the simplest idea in the world. Every business has always and will always create value for customers, suppliers, employees, communities, and the people with the money, and maybe some others as well. But those five are certainly necessary. Now, sometimes they destroy value for one of those. They don't usually mean to, but they can. So it's really a very simple idea, theoretically, about what the unit of analysis in business is. Yeah. Economists make a mistake because they tell us that the unit of analysis is a transaction, and we can look transaction by transaction. But that's not how business actually works. Business, real companies think about their relationships, not as a discrete set of transactions, but as something that you want to continue over time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. You touch certain key points and the points, and if I may play, you know, devil's advocate for a little bit, is the argument that, and this is what is taught in mainly most business and economics classes, is the main objective of the firm is to maximize profits. And that maximization of profits at any cost and given the context and regulations, firms might find ways to go around it and, as you said, destroy value for others not involved in the mm-hmm. transaction. So those that are outside the transaction are going to be pushed to the side as long as regulation doesn't come in. But the point that you make is that regulation should be inner or endogenously driven by the firm that wants to survive in the long term. And even though it might not immediately return into higher cash flows, it does return a process of engagement with community that creates value, which means there is a value proposition that goes beyond just what the exchange of the goods and services will happen with the customers. And a lot of times, we don't teach that part, right? And And so the idea of what you mentioned, that this is so obvious that it's out there, at the same time it's so obvious that we don't see it. Like, you know, air is there, we don't see it. We know it's there, but we don't see it. Or, you know, Newton saw what nobody else saw, which was gravity, right? Everybody has seen it. You know, no one has ever saw an apple going, you know, falling up. They always fall down. But the why has this to be the way you were able to conceptualize it and operationalize that concept. That's what we believe was the biggest value. You were able to put it together. So was it more your philosophy background, or was it more your business background that allowed you to see that?
I didn't have a business background, so couldn't have been that. Mm-hmm. I grew up poor on a farm in Georgia, and we didn't know what business was. When a guy on my dissertation committee said, you should do a postdoc at Wharton, honest to God, I said, what's Wharton? I'd never heard of it. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going there because my girlfriend at the time, now wife of 48 years, was in city planning school at Penn. Mm-hmm. So that part worked out. On the other side, I was trying to figure out how business worked because I didn't really know. And I got lucky to work with a number of companies at this research center I was with. And I would say it wasn't necessarily my philosophy background. It was my ignorance that caused this. I just didn't know how this worked. And so I was not trained to know that this was about maximizing shareholder value. I had done a lot of economics, but the economics I did was game theory and decision theory and, you know, thinking about how cooperation works, et cetera. And that's what I saw. You know, I saw stakeholders cooperating together, even though sometimes they didn't know that's what they were doing. Mm-hmm. One of the ways of interpreting the stakeholder idea is that there's more than just shareholders. And that's true. Another way to interpret it is that shareholders are not important, and that's not true. Shareholders are an important stakeholder. Businesses have to have money to live, just like I have to have red blood cells to live. But it doesn't follow that the purpose of my life is to make red blood cells, ever. Businesses must have profits to live. The people who think profits are bad just don't understand how business works. But it doesn't follow at all that making profits is the purpose of a business. Mm-hmm. You know, purpose is a multifaceted idea. I try to inspire my students as a purpose. It doesn't always happen, but I do my best. So I think for the most part, many business professors don't understand the idea of purpose and how powerful it is, mm-hmm. and that it's not purpose or profits. It's purpose and profits. Both of those things turn out to be important. I've been making angry, it's a nice way to say it, pundits on the left and the right for a long time. People on the left think I've sold out to business. I'm an apologist for business because they think profits are bad and business couldn't possibly do good. Correct. I think business, capitalism, if you like, is the most powerful system of cooperation we humans have ever invented. It's about how we can create value together. No one of us can do it alone. and so I've sold out, according to the people on the left. People on the right think I'm a communist because, you know, I think people need to be responsible for the effects of their action.
Yes.
You know, yeah, business is a great institution, and they need to be responsible for the effects of their action. That's what we try to teach our children. That's not I've never seen that as a big radical idea. I think the radical idea here, the one that doesn't make any sense, is that only investors count.
Correct.
Now, again, most people see the stakeholder idea as there's more than investors, right? And that's true. But what they miss, and this is the thing that's hardest to do, is that stakeholder interests are interdependent. How you manage the relationship with customers affects how you can manage the relationship with suppliers and employees. And that interdependence is what really characterizes this stakeholder idea. That's not as well understood as is the idea that it's more than shareholders here. Now, for the most part, businesses are way ahead of business rules here. Most business people certainly know there's more than shareholders. They'll talk about shareholder value on their earnings calls and when they're talking to shareholders and Wall Street, of course they will. But you listen to them talk to their customers, it's a very different thing. they are getting the message that these interests are interdependent. I mean, they know that kind of in their hearts. We're in the grip of this story that it's only about the money. It's only about shareholders. And as we loosen the grip of that story, people are doing some really incredible things. Now, the other thing I want to mention to your question is I'm a real fan of the short term. Maybe that's because I'm 73, you know, so long term is like next Tuesday.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be around for that.
Yeah.
I've heard for a long time that this ethics and stakeholder stuff makes sense in the long term, doesn't make sense in the short term. Short term, we got to worry about the money. Well, as a short term moves towards the long term, when does it start to make sense? Well, it doesn't because the long term moves.
Right.
You know, so I've been distrustful of this distinction about short term and long term. What we need to do is figure out how to get stakeholder interests going in the same direction in the short term.
Correct.
It doesn't pay if you were to say to your students, look, in the long term, Loyola is going to be more student-oriented. Don't worry. In the long term, it's going to be more student-oriented. And one of them is going to say, wait a minute, when does that start happening? Well, it's going to happen. We're doing things. It's going to happen. No, you got to figure out how to do it now. You know, and the idea here is that stakeholder interests can conflict. There's no question about that. But what you want to do is you want to harmonize their interest. And I like the metaphor of harmonize because in music, the notes are different, but you can make them sound good together.
Yeah.
And so trying to figure out how to harmonize these interests now in the short term, it works better if you have some purpose. And that purpose has to be more than just worry about the money.
Yes.
Money's important. I'm a big fan of shareholder value as well. But it's shareholder value and stakeholder value.
Would it be fair to say that, because, as you mentioned, short and long term, I think it was Keynes that said, in the long run.
We're all dead.
And yes, and so we have to make decisions in the shorter term. Can we say that firms that do engage in a stakeholder, a more harmonized process are able to achieve a competitive advantage over other firms and hence, yes, their value goes up, but at the same time, they're able to counterbalance the positive negatives, possible negatives that you might have. And so short term is still driven by that competitive advantage that they may gain as they differentiate.
Well, again, it depends on how you see this. People say, if I manage my business to create value for stakeholders, am I guaranteed of financial success? That's what they want to know. The answer to that's obviously no. Just like the answer to, if I try to maximize shareholder value, am I guaranteed to maximize shareholder value? The answer to that's absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Global financial crisis should have proven that to everybody. Why? Because the world's complicated. People make mistakes. We don't know everything. We're, as economists would say, boundedly rational.
Correct.
So it doesn't. But there's a better question. This is the thing I think philosophers are good at, is trying to figure out better questions. I think the better question is, if I manage my business this way, is it possible that I'm going to be financially successful? What does the research on that say? Research on that is in. The answer is absolutely, it's possible. No guarantees. You want a guarantee, get a puppy.
Yeah.
You know, they'll pretty much lick your hand regardless or as I've often said, buy a refrigerator. They actually come with guarantees. Management theories don't come with guarantees. None of them do. Mm-hmm. But You want to know, is it possible? Now, what some people would say is, no, it's not possible. There's always a trade-off. And what I want to suggest is there are trade-offs that you have to make sometimes. But if that's all you look for is trade-offs, I am certain that's all you're going to find.
Correct.
Can you figure out how to, what a good friend of mine would say, can you find win-win-win-wins? Can you find ways for customers to win, for suppliers to win, for employees to win, for communities to win, and investors to win? And what we're seeing is two things. One, the answer is obviously yes, you can find those things, and companies do find those things. And two, the more you ask that question, the easier it gets to answer it. In other words, you build a skill trying to find win-wins. And that's just a skill we all know. When we first start in our personal lives, when we first start having a relationship with somebody, it looks like there's a lot of conflict. I want that. They want that. How do we deal with that? Over time, we get better at finding win-wins, you know, and there's no difference between thinking about relationships in our personal lives and thinking about them in business.
Now, when you say that we learn to find win-wins, is it that we learn to value things differently, or that we recognize the value of things that we were not taught or educated to see from the get-go?
Sometimes I think it's a little bit of both. We certainly can change what we value. If I think about my 48-year marriage, there's some stuff that I thought I valued, which I didn't. Mm-hmm. And then there's some stuff I learned about my partner that I didn't know, that I didn't know this was a win for her.
Yeah.
And that's the in business, that's the real thing here, because customers are – it's not just about the money. It's often about what a product can do, how it can improve their lives. And the money is the means here. And so if you think about the currencies, the multiple currencies that are there in any relationship, then that helps you find win-win-wins. And that's the trick. But if you don't see it as a relationship, it doesn't work. And I would say there are three things about relationship thinking that's different than transaction thinking. One is, in a relationship, there's a presumption it's going to continue. If there's no presumption it's going to continue, it's a transaction. It's a one night or one transaction thing.
End of the game. Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that, but it's not a relationship. And for there to be a presumption it's going to continue, both parties have to care. They have to care about that. They have to care about each other. And does that mean I should care about my stakeholders? Absolutely. I have one of my friends who's built a pretty big company says, you know, you got to love your stakeholders. And I think that's right. If you see it as kind of roving gangs of stakeholders out to get me, it doesn't work. Think about the university. You know, if we're going to be successful, we have to love our alums. And our students, and the faculty. Faculty have to care about the administrators, you know. And it would be nice if we cared about the community that we were in. And we find ways to do that. So presumption is going to continue. Parties have to care about each other. And the third thing is you don't have to keep score all the time. If you're always keeping score in a relationship, it's not a relationship. You're counting the transactions. If I were to go back to Darden, where my wife works as well as administrator, and I go, hey, babe, you know, I was in New Orleans, and I've been thinking about our relationship, and I think you're up three. I think you owe me three over these 48 years. I know what would happen. Well, she's a second-degree black belt in Taekwondo. I've had my hips replaced. I can't really run. It would not be a healthy conversation.
Yes.
Why? You don't have to keep score. I mean, look, sometimes relationships end, and that's painful, and I understand all that. But if you keep in score every day, you don't have a relationship, or not one that's going to last.
Yeah. Ali.
No, I mean, you touched such an interesting pool of perspective. You started like discussing about misconceptions, then you moved on, moving from this like conception of just working with trade-offs and with transactions and thinking about more harmonizing relationship, starting from the very short term and then building your long-term value, right? In particular, I want to ask you something that starts from one thing that you said right a couple of minutes ago. People make mistakes, of course, and also the world is becoming complex and even more complex. And I would add, it's even becoming more complex today, thinking about our overall discussion of stakeholder management through the introduction and the widespreading of AI technology. Because now we have kind of like a new bunch of new stakeholders, right? That companies never have to deal with like in the past, right? So how this advent of AI, which now everyone now is using, companies are using them for now dealing with a specific part of the value chain, customer service, part of supply, defining ways to maximize inbound, outbound logistics. Still customer uses now to deal with companies. So how this diffusion of AI makes things even more complex today to do what you said, to look for harmonizing rather than trade-offs, to look for ways for everyone to win.
Mm-hmm. Well, the real answer is I don't know. Obviously, I've thought about this some. We just sort of finished a draft of a paper on how to understand AI as in stakeholder theory. But I hope what we do is we keep human beings in the loop. You know, that we think about human AI. Yeah. We've just started a center at Darden called the Center for Ethical AI to try to understand how that works. It's tricky. I mean, it depends on how you think AI is going to go. how are we going to, this is one of the things I'm going to talk about later today. What's it going to be like? How are we going to deal with the fact that this thing we're going to have in our phones, that we can have in our phones now, is smarter than we are. Yeah. Now, right now, it makes a lot of mistakes, and it makes stuff up when it doesn't know. We've had that happen in pretty severe ways. But I hope we look at AI like we look at other tools. How can it help us live better? How can it help us find win-win-wins? I really think it has a lot of potential for that. Of course, there are going to be misuses. Of course, there are going to be unanticipated consequences. And there are going to be consequences of kind of what it does to us as human beings. I'll never forget walking into a restaurant in Charlottesville and seeing four young people at a table. College students, high school students, I wasn't sure what. And they were sitting at the table. They weren't talking to each other. They all had their screens out. They were looking at their screens. And I began to wonder, why were they having dinner with each other? You know, those kinds of consequences. Yeah. I have twin daughters, and they have been known to text each other at the table. when they wanted to say something to each other, they didn't want mom and dad to hear.
Yeah.
I understand those things. But those are going to be real. You know, think about the number of young people. It's pretty stunning. I think I don't remember the number, but I remember being amazed who have relationships. I'm using that in the way we would normally use it. With an AI,
yeah,
you know that I don't know what that's like, you know, or what the world's going to be like when most of our relationships are mediated by screens,
yeah,
or mediated by
by an algorithm.
And screens now, but there'll be an
agent.
There'll be an agent that we can implant to improve our brains and those kinds of things. I think those things are pretty formidable that we need to think about. Mm-hmm. They go well beyond stakeholder theory, though it certainly AIs will affect that as well. I hope we look at the technology as how can this make our lives better. Social media, for all the negative publicity it gets, has made our lives better. I'm in touch with people that I'm glad I am, who I would have completely not been in touch with.
Yeah.
You know, I learn about things that I wouldn't have known about.
Yeah.
You know, there are other negative consequences too. So I think we just have to we have to keep thinking about how can we use this technology to make our lives better. That's human history. How can we use technology to make our lives better? If there are always going to be people who think about how to make it worse or how to take advantage of it only for themselves, and we're not going to get rid of that. I don't think.
Yeah.
If I may, you know, the Nobel Prize this year was given to three individuals, and I'm going to focus particularly on John and Howitt on their argument that through Schumpeterian creative destruction, investment in technology and innovation is a key factor to move economic growth and provide opportunities for most people. In other words, without innovation, we will be back to low levels of standards of living. But at the same time, they argue that the risk of some new technologies is overinvestment. And that overinvestment could result in low returns on some of that investment, and hence investment fails, and only few can succeed. In a follow-up, the editor, Taylor, out of the Journal of Economic Perspectives, were arguing that we observed this happening already with the dot-com, where there was significant overinvestment, and one company came out of strong, we know the name of that company, and has taken then the market by pretty much rule it almost as a platform, and hence creates issues in terms of stakeholders and relationships among individuals because it's driven by mainly transactional elements and has come under a lot of scrutiny. And I'm trying to refrain from saying the name. I'm not going to say the name of the company, but I think we know what the company is. Can this be the case of AI? Too many companies investing, too many companies going around, and we end up with one company being the leader on AI and hence significant market power concentration.
I mean, it could be, but again, the very idea of innovation, we like to think we live in a world of scarcity, and this is a sort of a common view of economists who worry about transactions and sort of stuff. I don't think so. I think we live in a world of abundance. If we take into account what we're able to do with our minds, think about it. From coming down from the savannas of Africa in my world, maybe not yours, but in mine, to making iPhones. Mm-hmm. So think about what we had to invent. We had to invent vocabularies. We had to invent fields like chemistry and physics and metal. And had to figure out how glass worked. Human mind is pretty impressive about that. So even that one giant company has come under attack for a lot of things. Now the problem with creative destruction is, and I don't disagree with their views about innovation and how that's worked, but creative destruction misses the idea that the modern corporation allows for continuous creation. And I would say it's continuous creation that they should have talked about in this rather than creative destruction. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, somebody can invent something that makes buddy whips not very useful, but if the buddy whip corporation understands that it can be a part of that or invent the next generation— you have corporations who last for a long time. They last for a long time primarily because they have some sense of purpose, because they, in my view, have paid attention to their stakeholders, et cetera. And they have escaped Schumpeter's creative destruction. Escaped it. What they've done is made it irrelevant because they've invented new technologies, new products, et cetera. Creative destruction works and makes sense if you think about economics as their buyers and their sellers, and it's about transactions. When you think about it differently, when I'm trying to make your life as my customer better, then I'm not restricted to kind of one product. And so I think these folks deserve the Nobel Prize for their work on innovation, because it's innovation that's the engine of capitalism. Mm-hmm. But innovation works best, again, when you think about it, not that you need an optimal amount of investment in anything, but you're thinking about creating stakeholder value, not just financial value in economics. And it's not about shared value. Every economic transaction creates social effects. Every social transaction creates economic effects. So the problem is you try to pull them apart. And that's for the most part what I think many theorists don't understand. Don't worry about economic or social value. Worry about stakeholder value. It doesn't matter whether it's economic or social or political or spiritual. What I want to do is create enough value so that you stay with my company. And there are lots of ways to do that, as many companies have shown us. Mm-hmm.
Now, this brings us to the conversation, I think, because I keep on hearing on the other end of the conversation the old saying that the business of business is business, and that leaves a lot of ideas of other values out of the conversation.
No, it doesn't. No, the business of business is business. Now, look at one. What do? They create value for their customers, not just financial value. I buy my iPhone. It's not just what I paid for it. I have a music studio on there. I have lots of other things I can do. I can be in touch with my friends. The business of business is business, but the business of business is its stakeholders. Without that, they don't exist. Take customers away. What do you have? No business. Take employees away or treat them badly so that they don't put out very much effort. You don't have a business. When people say the business of business is business, what they usually mean is the business of business is money. Mm-hmm. And that's a mistake. Yes. It's just not understanding how means and ends work.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you so much, because that is one of the common conversations that students equate with profits. And then if the conversation ends in profits, then it ends there, right? And the purpose of the teaching that occurs in the classroom turns into, okay, my responsibility is only to make money, and that's it. And of course, it's a short view of what individuals have to do.
Well, I had this conversation with at a pretty unpleasant dinner recently, which there was an ex-congressman there who had served for a long time, and he said, "Well, Ed, suppose I only care about the money. Suppose that's all I care about." I said, "Okay, let's suppose you're the most narcissistic, greedy, money-grubbing
Grinch,
bastard in the world. And that's all you care about." He says, "Yeah, okay." And I just said, "How are you going to make it?" He said, "What?" I said, "Well, you better have some customers who want your product. And by the way, you need suppliers who are trying to make you better. It's a lot easier if they're trying to make you better and to help you. You want employees who are not just showing up to, to get a paycheck. You want them to be engaged in the business." I said, "You want communities who are at least not going to pass laws to run you out," and there are plenty of those. "And if you do those things, you get lucky, you might make money." So I don't understand this only the money counts here. If you don't manage the other relationships, if you don't care about the other relationships, you're not going to make any money, or you won't make it for long. And that's the trick. People see it as stakeholders versus shareholders, and take the versus out or the or out and put and in there. It's both of those things. Is one more important than the other? Well, they're interconnected. So the idea of trying to find the priority here is a mistake. You have to see, first of all, what's the interconnection? And if I can figure out that interdependence, then I'm likely to be able to have a business that's going to last for a long time.
Now, may I build up here on the concept that you mentioned earlier? You said that your exposure to economics was small in a way, but that you were very well versed in game theory. Mm-hmm. And in game theory, the biggest contributions, I guess, is the ability to see short term versus long term. A game that doesn't end on the first try goes into the second one, and that is to me the analogy to the and an or. Mm-hmm. And so how can you turn that game theory to go from an or to an end? And so you have now a second and then a third and then a fourth.
Well, again, you have to get out of this transactional way of thinking. You know, if you think there's no such thing as a one-shot game, you know, a one-play game, I can meet you later. I may not know it, but I can. Yeah. And how I meet you later, if I've treated you badly the first time, affects the second time. So, you know, I think it's about seeing life as a set of relationships in which you're enmeshed, not a set of transactions in which you're trying to maximize your short-term economic self-interest. I think the game theorists have explored that in a way, but even they sometimes make the mistake of saying, well, that's just a set of transactions that because you don't know what the future brings, that's a reason for doing it. I think that's a disrespectful view of what human beings are, this idea that we're one-dimensional maximizers of our own self-interest. Anybody who's ever had a child, anybody who's ever been in love knows we're more than that. We're capable of incredible acts of kindness and love. We're capable of incredible nasty acts too. That's there too. But human beings are at once self-interested and other-regarding, and those things go together in us. And splitting them apart and saying, "Well, self-interest is economics," and then altruism is ethics, doesn't work that way. I mean, even somebody who I think was as messed up about ethics as Immanuel Kant was understood that we had duties to self, that wasn't just about altruism. Mm-hmm. So, that's another one of these dichotomies. Yes. that we like to think cut the world at its joints, but it doesn't really. We're incredibly complicated. Business works because we're incredibly complicated. You know, the only people that are self-interested all the time, who want to maximize their short-term self-interest, there are people like that. We call them sociopaths. And then, this is nonpartisan now, we often elect them to office. And I want to be clear, that's nonpartisan. We're complicated, and we need, in business schools especially, we need the full breadth of the humanities to understand our humanness. One of the great things about all the Loyolas, all of the Jesuit universities and others, is they understand that. It was the Jesuit universities who were the leaders in business ethics. They're the ones who started the field as an academic field. And at least in the U.S. And that's something we need more of the humanities in business, not less. The others, accounting, finance, all that stuff's important. I mean, you got to know that stuff. Yeah, but that's not going to make you a great business leader. It's your understanding of what a human being is and how human beings work together and can work together. That's what makes great business leaders.
You mentioned something that of course, sounds with us, which is, standing in issues, educate the whole person.
Yeah.
And it is a process of, yes, you have to be very thoughtful and tough and attention to detail to the academics. You have to push the students to the limit in economics and business, philosophy, literature, writing, oral speaking. But you also have to touch the humanity of the individual. And you
yes.
have to tell, remind us that we are just a little part of a bigger thing. in within our faith. You know, that's essential. So if we create big brains with no heart, it doesn't work. And if we create only big hearts with no brain, then it doesn't work either. So educating the whole person for us is a centerpiece of advancing the mission of St. Ignatius in any other form of, you know, Catholicism that we have. But it's key. It's key to understand that we are just one part of something bigger. And it is our duty to use our capacities to the best that we can to, yes, have a good life, but also serve others.
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. But I understand how that's in many people and institutions of faith, but it needs to be in people and institutions who are not of faith as well. And I don't think it's necessarily, though it is more easily understood in religious or organizations, but it needs to be understood in others as well. I mean, the Darden School is not affiliated with any mm-hmm. religious thing. Jefferson wrote the statute of religious freedom, mm-hmm. etc. But we take this very seriously. There are five of us who we see ourselves as we're the humanities faculty for the business school. We teach courses in theater, in literature, some in history, and ethics, of course. If you just want to learn accounting and finance, well, for starters, business school is not going to be around because AIs can do that. Exactly. Probably, probably not as well yet, but they will. Right, you know, there. So, you know, as I've often said, we better figure out how to help people build their creative imaginations. Mm-hmm. Because the AI is going to do everything else.
In particular, like I'm going to attach to your last comment, and since you mentioned, okay, what should be then the mission of business school looking forward? And so my question, and we're like moving towards the end of our episode, is it if you have to give like a student a suggestion how to navigate this complexity, if let's say these students would have been like thinking about opening his own enterprise, his own venture, and then he or she will have to deal with the stakeholders, right? So what would be your main suggestion to these students? How can he or she navigate all the complexity?
Well, I see this as in part a question about, well, what does it mean to be authentic? How can you figure out how to live an authentic life? And for me, that's not a matter of just knowing your values. That's what people say. Well, know your values. Remember in Shakespeare, this above all, to thine own self be true, and thou canst be false to any man. What people, most people don't know is that Shakespeare is making fun of Polonius. He thought Polonius was a fool. Why? Because there isn't a person in literature who's less aware of their values than Hamlet, right? He doesn't know if he wants to be king. He doesn't know if he loves Ophelia. He doesn't know, you know, anything about that. And the plays is him searching for some authenticity, which he never finds. So I see this as a project. You just start from what you think your values are. But then you have to think about, well, what do you really want? What are your aspirations? All of this is bounded by of understanding your history, of where you've come from, where has transference is great psychoanalytic idea that, you know, I take my relationships with some and transfer it on to others, especially those in early childhood. You have to be aware of your history, and you have to understand the relationships you're enmeshed in. You know, and if you can keep thinking about those four things, Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living, and that's kind of what this project of being authentic is. I don't think there's any magic. There are lots of techniques. There are lots of tools. We can teach them all that. But without this drive to have a sense of purpose, to make a difference in the world, and to do that in an authentic way in which you're cognizant of your set of relationships, you're trying to deal with your history, you understand that you have values, but you may not be the best person to know what those are. I think after Freud, We should be skeptical that we're the best people to know what's in our hearts. We have to constantly be involved with those people that we're in relationships with for that. And, you know, to have some idea of aspiration. What kind of mark are we trying to make on the world? Mm-hmm. I've often said, as the older I've gotten, I've become more and more certain about fewer and fewer things. I mean, there's some stuff I'm more certain about. There's a whole lot of stuff that, hey, there are lots of ways to live. Lots of ways to live authentically. And I'm pretty skeptical of people who try to tell us the way to live. You know, we humans are pretty cool. Yeah. You know, we've done a lot, but we've done a lot because, you know, we can use our minds and we can care for others, and that's something that I think we need to do more of in business schools. Yeah. To teach people. Right now, I think the dominant idea is of the heroic business person, the heroic entrepreneur, mm-hmm. And that's too bad.
Yeah.
Because I don't think there are many of those out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a final question, Gustavo?
Well, yes. Of course, we have talked about a plethora of very interesting topics, and we'll have the opportunity to engage with a little bit more with the students later on. We're hoping to also have the chance to briefly meet the faculty. Later today, we have a faculty meeting, so I'm trying to work still 5 minutes of the meeting so that I can introduce you to them, and they have the chance to, the pleasure that we have had to be to engage in a very small conversation. But to us, the importance of what we do, and I often tell my students, I love college so much that I never left. I entered in 84, and I had my try at that, the stock exchange, and I said, this is not for me. The money is good, but this is not for me. The purpose is not there, right?
It's a sweet gig, and it's certainly not gathering hay in the hot Georgia sun.
Yeah. And so I stay here, and I'm like, I make my life, and so did my wife also. She's also a professor. We make the life of educating the young minds into becoming the best they can be by giving them the tools to be, you know, good citizens and maximize the capacity to do good in this world. So the question, you know, the final thought that I would like to hear from you is, how can we, while teaching standard material, create opportunities for students to find themselves?
Well, that's a question I think about all the time. You know, I don't know about standard material. We create our own material. You know, I think that's probably, for me, that's what it takes. The other thing is so many professors care about their research. I do too, but that's all they care about. They see teaching as a way to earn money to do their research. If I were to ever walk into a classroom and think I can't learn something from the students, I don't think I'd walk in another one. It's a joint enterprise. We're trying to teach students to be the best they can be, and they push us to be the best that we can be. And I think, again, that interdependence has, for me, I've been teaching for almost 50 years, and that's always been there. I'm going to not do that in another couple of years. I'm going to retire, and I will miss that. There's no question about that. I think the only thing I would say is we have to be role models. Not role models and be perfect. Nobody is like that. But we have to live what we say, especially those of us that teach ethics. You know, I have the best job in the world. I teach at a school that really takes students seriously. We are absolutely, you can be the best person in your field in the world, and if you're not committed to teaching, you won't be a Darden. You know, we really put our money where our mouth is. That's not to say we get it all right all the time, of course not, but it is to say, I'm very proud to be a part of such a student-centered place. The result of that is it's a community. with everything from, see, we have about 1,000 students. I'll get to know at least half of them in their two years there. We have a student faculty staff band we've had for 20 years that we play together. We play music together. We do all kinds of community oriented thing. If all I wanted to do was write my papers and do the minimum amount of teaching, I probably, when I was younger, could have gotten one of those jobs, but I would have been miserable because, you know, that sense of community is incredibly important. So I think we need more of those, not fewer. What I've often said is the problem most business school professors are trying to solve is how do I get my research published in A-star journals? Mm-hmm. And that's just not an interesting problem. Mm-hmm. Not interesting to business, not interesting to anybody but themselves, quite honestly.
Well, thank you so much, Ed, for what I believe is a very interesting conversation we had. I think like an amazing episode came out of it,
yes.
Right?
Absolutely. This is a very, very engaging conversation, you know, part of why we are in the university, so we can advance and understand all that we do not know. Socrates was very right. I do not know much, and what I know is very little. And if then, but the possibility to exchange these ideas and conversations, we hope that is going to reach a good large audience, and we can continue doing the work that we do, which is, you know, advance the students' growth, and yes, the field as well, but students' growth, one person at a time, giving back. Because when I hear the word, you know, stakeholder, it comes to mind also stewardship. It is the possibility of giving back to others above and beyond what we get paid for, but have an impact in the life of others. So, Ed, we want to thank you, Loyola University, both the Center for International Business and the Center for Ethics and Economic Justice, and of course, you know, the College of Business. And our podcast, Gumbo of Opportunities, because I believe we have created a lot of opportunities through this conversation to better understand and advance those areas in which we're still lacking, and no one claims we'll ever know, but advancing and providing students, our main audience, the possibility to listen a little bit more in depth to this concept. So we thank you very much for this possibility.
Thank you. It's been a real honor. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Gumbo of Opportunities, the podcast about international business of Southern Louisiana and New Orleans. Huge thanks to Farah, Oban, and all the staff involved for making this podcast possible. The music is New Orleans Jazz Guitar Music by The Music Hive.